this time on your weekly Constitutional.
What I mean by the cult of the Constitution is this kind of reverence that Americans have for the Constitution. Reverence that's not always backed up by either knowledge or consistency, but it's definitely a very strong, passionate, emotional attachment to the Constitution. There is a healthy way to be reverential, and there's an unhealthy way. And what my book focuses on are the times and the ways in which we are not so healthy.
That was Mary Ann Franks, who teaches constitutional law at the University of Miami's School of Law. This week, we'll talk about her new book. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and it's about the cult of the Constitution.
Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
Mary Ann Franks teaches at the University of Miami's School of Law. Her area of specialty is constitutional law, and specifically something that has to do with the First Amendment, something called revenge pornography. If you're a longtime listener, you might have heard her several years ago when we did an entire episode simply called Revenge Porn. If you want to listen to it now, go to our podcast site or Spotify or iTunes and look for Revenge Porn. Today, we're going to talk about something different. We're going to talk about her new book. It's called The Cult of the Constitution. And it's a fascinating discussion of how some people don't read the Constitution, they don't know about the Constitution, and yet they seem to worship the Constitution.
I'm Mary Ann Franks. I'm a law professor at the University of Miami School of Law.
And you are here at Montpelier because?
I'm here at Montpelier because I am co-teaching this extraordinary seminar with you about sex, drugs, and rock and roll and the Constitution.
Is that like the coolest title of any seminar you've ever taught or attended?
Well, I have to say I've had some pretty good ones in the past, but this is right up there.
This came about in a very funny way. Montpelier plans these things well in advance. It was about a year and a half ago that I get a call from Emily Voss, who's in charge of these programs. I think maybe Raquel Suarez was on the phone with her, and they were both sort of laughing. And they said, "Stuart, we've decided we're going to do a new seminar," and we immediately knew it had to be you. And I said, "What? Sex, drugs, rock and roll, Constitution and vice?" And I said, "That is right up my, that's in my wheelhouse." And then almost instantly, I thought of you, because of course you want two teachers, and you are, of course, an expert on the very, very troubling subject of revenge pornography. And we, in fact, had an entire episode devoted to that a couple of years ago. And so if anyone's interested, just Google your weekly Constitutional, go to our podcast site, look for the search bar, enter in porn or revenge. Either one will bring it right up, and you'll be able to hear our discussion. The only thing about that discussion is probably a bit dated now, which we'll get into here in a minute. But in the meantime, you've been busy, and you have just about finished a book, right?
I have.
What is this new book?
This new book is titled The Cult of the Constitution.
The Cult of the Constitution.
Yes, and the subtitle is Guns, Speech, and the Internet.
Guns, Speech, and the Internet. Well, let's take those one by one. What do you mean by the cult of the Constitution?
What I mean by the cult of the Constitution is this kind of reverence that Americans have for the Constitution. Reverence that's not always backed up by either knowledge or consistency, but it's definitely a very strong, passionate, emotional attachment to the Constitution.
And what wait a minute. You just described me.
Well, yes, probably I've described a lot of people.
You've come to the center of the cult, and now you're a heretic. You're a blasphemer.
Yes, I get that a lot.
Okay, all right. So what happens? What's the downside of all this Constitution worship?
Well, so it doesn't have to have a downside. There is a healthy way to be reverential, and there's an unhealthy way. And what my book focuses on are the times and the ways in which we are not so healthy. And what I mean by that is I'm looking at a comparison between constitutional fanaticism and religious fanaticism. Mm-hmm. So in the same way that we can see examples of people taking scriptures, let's say the Bible or the Quran, and saying we have to live by the scripture and we have to live by these very specific interpretations of the scripture. And anyone who disagrees with me is a heretic. And anyone who disagrees with me doesn't deserve to be part of this community anymore. At that point, I think you really do see the problem that what happens with constitutional fanaticism, like religious fanaticism, is people take out pieces of the text and say, that's what I really want to focus on. So freedom of speech is more important than anything else in the world, or the right to bear arms is the most important thing. And what tends to happen is we ignore all the parts of that really important text that might give us some more nuance or some more sophistication or some complexity or some conflict. And so, for instance, people don't tend to think of the 14th Amendment very often, as often as they think about guns or about speech. And so that's the problem. When we stop paying attention to the text as a whole and we stop caring about the consequences on the people around us, at that point we become fanatical, and at that point we can do a lot of damage to our society, but also to our constitutional understanding.
Marianne, you have described the reason that I started this radio show. I got so sick and tired of what I refer to as Constitution thumpers. Mm. There's an old expression. I think you grew up Southern Baptist. My wife did as well. I was from a very conservative Christian denomination as well, and we referred to Bible thumpers. You know, you've seen the preachers who get up there and wave the text around and bang on it.
That was my preacher.
Yeah, precisely. And, you know, you listen to them for a few minutes and you wonder why it is that they seem to only focus upon certain passages and ignore others that might be the next word over. I mean, you know, clauses they will pluck out. You know, it's terrible to be homosexual, but it's perfectly okay to wear two different sorts of cloth that are woven together, or to do all of the other prohibited things. So there's that, and you see exactly the same phenomenon. I mean, as you say, I mean, they'll pick out one or two things they really care about, and, you know, and I suppose I'm guilty of that because I'm a big free speech guy, always have been. But it's good to question that from occasionally, isn't it? And as you pointed out today, the 14th Amendment followed the First Amendment. And so by standard canons of statutory interpretation, if there is a conflict between the two, then the later legislative enactment should generally prevail, because the Congress or the people who ratified it in this particular case presumptively knew about the First Amendment and were amending the Constitution anyway. Cool ideas. Please continue. You're the one writing the book.
Right. So exactly as you say, there's a sense in which not only are we talking about not paying attention to certain parts of the text as much as we should, we're talking about ignoring potential conflicts between the two. So to take your example, if we think of free speech in isolation, then we only think about it in terms of whoever happens at that particular moment to be making a free speech claim. And we don't think about whether or not those free speech claims that we have defended for so long might have mostly accrued to the benefit of a certain group of people, whereas the free speech rights of other people maybe just weren't that much a part of our priorities. And if that's the case, then we are looking at potentially a 14th Amendment problem, and at least in the specific sense of equal protection of the laws. If we are thinking that the things we gave ourselves, right, in those first 10 amendments or so are really important, freedom of speech, the right to defend ourselves, then we should definitely care about the fact that those rights are not equally apportioned across society. And even if we shouldn't have to care about that just as a policy matter, I think the Constitution demands that we do so. So at any point that we only focus on the freedom of speech rights or the right to bear arms rights of powerful members of society, we are betraying this other part of the Constitution, which, in my view, essentially does apply to the entire Constitution and to all of our laws. There's no exception to the 14th Amendment. You can't say, well, equal protection except for, you know, the first or the second. It's always got to comport with the 14th Amendment's obligations.
You made a very good point in our general discussion last night at the beginning of the seminar when we were discussing questions like what is a constitution, what is an individual right, and when I made the point that generally speaking the Supreme Court interprets individual rights negatively, that is, protecting us only against the predations of government, you interjected a very nuanced and interesting idea into the conversation, and that is that you have to think about who these rights benefit, and you have to go all the way back to the beginning. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Certainly. If we think about, and we've been taught as part of this kind of constitutional reverential culture we have, every school child learns that at this point in time with the founding fathers, we get told that they did this kind of magical thing, that they, through a process of compromise and debate, that they came up with something that really was going to protect we the people. And what gets lost in that conversation is something that's so obvious that people tend to think of it as not important, which is to say that every person who was in that room belonged to a very narrow category. That is to say, they were all white, and they were all male, and they were all landowners. And if you ask a group of people with those characteristics what's important to them, of course it seems to make sense that they're going to say, well, what I'm worried about is hanging on to what I have, because I have all of these things. My major concern about this new government will be whether or not that government takes some stuff away from me. So I'm going to write these rights in terms of protecting my interests. But if we think about the majority of the population at that time, they weren't white male landowners. They were slaves. They were women. They were Native Americans. And so if we're thinking about it from their perspective, wouldn't they have asked for different kinds of rights? If we were trying to think of what those people would have needed, they might have said very different things. And so when we talk about who the Bill of Rights really protects, from its very origin, it seems to have protected the people who already had power. It was not written as a way for people to truly get equality. It was written for a way to perpetuate the very hierarchy that already existed at the time.
So what you're talking about is what might generally be called positive rights. So I wouldn't simply say that I have a right to prevent the government from taking something from me, like my freedom of speech or my gun, but I have the right to expect that the government will do certain things. And what sort of positive rights do you think would be appropriate?
I think that's one way of expressing it, the idea of positive rights. Another way of thinking of it is, who's a threat to me and who do I need to be guarded against? But some of those rights might include saying, I want to be able to have this fundamental right to my own body, right? So a slave, I think, certainly would have said, if I had the chance to write the government right now, I would say, I want to make sure this government protects my right to be free of subordination, to be free of actual physical oppression. I would have thought that you would ask women what they might have wanted. They want to be free from violence, I think. Their concerns might have been, I want to make sure that my husband isn't allowed to simply abuse me or to rape me, because at the time, marital rape was not considered a crime. I think you would have wanted some kind of assurances from this new government that people would be allowed to, at a minimum, live their lives freely, free of physical oppression, but also have some kind of security in terms of being able to provide for themselves, to provide for their families without being impoverished. So I think that if we'd asked a broader group of people, we might have gotten something like that as an emerging consensus.
It's so interesting. We were having a lunchtime conversation, I think, or perhaps it was this morning between sessions, and we were talking about the fact that, well, no, it was last night, which when you and I and my wife were sitting around the table, and we realized that all three of our families had been transformed by a common thing, and that was the GI Bill. Mm-hmm. Your dad went to college, GI Bill. My dad was the first in his family to go to college, GI mm-hmm. Bill. My wife's father, first in his family, and all of them then became professionals, and all of them gave their own children a much greater start in life. And then later on, I mentioned that it was called the GI Bill of Rights, and I saw a look of surprise in your mm-hmm. face. Most people, I think, would be surprised. It's simply called the GI Bill for so long that we forget that it was something that was championed by Franklin Roosevelt, and he very much saw economic rights, mm-hmm. positive rights, guarantees by the government that you're going to have a certain level of income, certain access to education, other things that he felt made it necessary before you could fully participate as an equal in a democracy. That was his vision. And indeed, it's encapsulated in some of the four freedoms. You know, we have a freedom of religion. We have freedom of speech. Mm-hmm. Those exist, at least on paper, as of 1941, I think, when he gave that speech. But then he said, freedom from fear, ours to gain. Mm. That's protection. That's government's responsibility. Right. And then freedom from want, which is precisely what we've been talking about, bringing it all the way back here. So mm-hmm. this idea of positive rights, it's pretty alluring, but it's not what the Constitution currently right. does for us.
And partly because the presumption was that those people who were in the room had those already. And so if we think of someone as taking for granted that they've got certain types of stability, then what they're going to ask for in the Constitution will be different from those who are deprived of those things. So if you were to ask someone who is a slave or who is a wife at the time with very few rights, how is concerned is she about the freedom of speech when she's not allowed to speak in public, right? How important is the right to bear arms, whatever that means, if you are a slave and someone can actually tell you where to go or whether or not you have to give up your weapons? So we're talking about a presumption that people already have certain things, but of course many people in society did not at that time and do not now have enough security to feel as though they can keep their family alive, much less talk about whether or not they get to stand up in the middle of a protest and say what they want to say. It's a question of priorities.
To a certain extent, political participation depends on a certain degree of leisure.
It does.
You've got to have the time to go and fold those pamphlets or make those calls or walk those neighborhoods. And that's why a lot of people on the lower end of the spectrum, socioeconomic, simply can't participate.
That's precisely right. And then there's added to that the question of security. If, as we know is the case now, you are, in particular, let's say a woman who's speaking out about political matters or even about cultural matters, we know that it is almost routine these days to be harassed, to be threatened. Now, how free can you be if you know that if you say something that upsets someone, that you will be threatened with sexual assault or death? So if we really had a commitment to free speech, it seems like our government should be really worried about those situations where people who are trying to express themselves are being essentially frightened into silence. That if we're worried about the so-called chilling effect, which is what a lot of First Amendment activists and advocates will talk about, well, the chilling effect of thinking that if I speak, I'm going to be threatened or I'm going to be harassed or someone is going to stalk me, well, then I can't be very free. So before we ever get to the question of the government doing something to me, I have to worry about my neighbor. And now in the internet age, I have to worry about anyone in the world maybe creating anxiety and fear about what I might say because they can threaten to hurt me and I don't know if it's true or not.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today my guest is Mary Ann Franks, a professor at the University of Miami, with whom I recently taught a seminar at Montpelier. While we were there, we sat down and recorded this interview all about her new book, The Cult of the Constitution. Stick around. And now let's return to our discussion with Mary Ann Franks of the University of Miami School of Law. We're speaking about her new book to be published later this year. It has a fascinating title, The Cult of the Constitution. And so to bring it back to the specific argument in your book, which is not yet done, so I've not had a chance to read it, though I'm increasingly looking forward to it, is that we have this cult of the Constitution. We exalt the rights that we feel are most important, rather like a religion, and we do so somewhat unthinkingly. And we don't realize that in doing so, we are ignoring vast swaths of society and that maybe we need to be a little bit more, Unitarian and fundamentalist. We need to start thinking about what we believe and questioning it. Is that a fair statement?
I think that is a fair statement. I wonder sometimes how much of it is that we don't think about it. I think there is definitely a powerful part of our society that thinks about the deprivations and is actually partly constitutionally fanatic for those purposes. That is, knowing that by invoking the Constitution, you can justify so many injustices. You could justify so much inequality. If the response to someone who is being victimized by anti-Semitic speech is, oh, but you have to live with the First Amendment, which is something that you're going to have to put up with, well, it's a way of telling people who are essentially marginalized or who are being targeted in some way that, well, we would worry about you except for the fact that we have this much more important abstract principle that may require you to feel unsafe, but that's just, you know, what we're going to have to do. Those people are usually quite well aware of the fact that this burden of, let's say, extremist speech does not fall on all of us equally. There are certain groups and populations that will have to suffer the consequences of that choice, and they not, you know, coincidentally tend to not be the same people as the ones saying we need to commit to this abstract principle. People who commit to the abstract principle very often don't have much actual stake in it because they know that they're not going to be on the receiving end.
I had a colleague at the University of Tennessee say something to me that was really very striking. We were arguing about religious freedom, and I was making sort of standard arguments about separation of church and state, and I was wary of so-called RFRAs. I thought perhaps they were doing more harm than good, and he just sat back in his chair and he said, that's because you're a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant man. Okay, you know, you don't really feel like your religious beliefs are going to be challenged or threatened, and other people do. And I had to think for a minute. I said, well, maybe you're right. Maybe it's my perspective here. It was why I'm championing sort of the traditional separationist sort of argument or the traditional free exercise arguments where basically it's a hands-off policy and nobody gets any exceptions. Maybe it's because I don't need any exceptions because my religion is pretty much baked into the fabric of society. So your argument is that these groups who champion abstract absolutism or almost absolutism when it comes to free speech are doing so because they're not the ones who are being harmed. So then that leads to the next question, which I think I know where you're going to go with this one. Does that mean that you would be in favor then of more restrictions, governmental restrictions on so-called hate speech?
I think the first thing we'd have to do if we were going to go in that direction is to figure out what we mean by hate speech. One of the things that prohibits us from having a good and deep conversation about these issues, and popular culture at least, is that we've developed a real mythology around the First Amendment. There is this kind of received wisdom about the First Amendment, and it's something that's perpetuated not just by lay people, but also by people who should know better, to act as though the First Amendment has always meant the same thing, that we've always had this really expansive notion of freedom of speech, that with, except for very, very narrow categories, that we protect everything. And that's simply not true. It's not true historically. It's not true in terms of what the Supreme Court has said. So the first thing we have to do is re-educate ourselves about the First Amendment, that it never was an absolute protection for speech. And the kinds of things we now consider to be speech, I think, to the extent that we care about this, the Founding Fathers would have been shocked and appalled, the idea that actions could be considered speech, or the fact that, you know, certain forms of commercial speech would be getting so much protection as they are now. So we really have to reorient ourselves around the fact that freedom of speech has never meant something absolute. Once we realize that for throughout history, we've been making balancing tests, essentially, between the value of the speech and the harm that it causes, then we need to realize that if that's the case, we're only really looking at the question of how to calculate those harms and those benefits. And throughout history, we've had a tendency to really elevate the interests of those who are powerful and to sort of trivialize and to act as though it's not quite as serious when we're talking about harms to people who are disadvantaged. And we would certainly need to start thinking about that differently. If we can have First Amendment compliant regulations on securities fraud, if we can have them on copyright, if we can have them on child pornography or conspiracy, if we can say that we have this all this body of law that says there are forms of expression that we are not going to grant the entire protection of the First Amendment, then we need to understand that maybe that category is very much under-inclusive at this point. It's a sense in which we are basically arguing what kinds of harms matter. And in our country, we have very much recognized that financial harms matter. So we can say things about price fixing and about securities regulation, but when it comes to people's dignity or their autonomy or their safety or their security, we are not as keen to say that that's a real harm and to classify it as a real harm. So I think we would need to start rethinking that. What do we consider to be actually detrimental to society? Don't we need to have a better definition of that and a better category for that before we can make decisions about what's protected by the First Amendment?
Well, then, what do you think that would look like? I mean, if we need a definition, do you have a working definition? Do you have a proposal in your book of what you would prohibit as so-called hate speech? Or
what I do offer in my book is some things that we could do, not as a broad category of hate speech, because I think if not for any other purposes other than path dependence, we don't really want to create brand new categories that people find hard to define. The problem with the category of hate speech is that no one seems to really agree on what it is. Some people mean by hate speech, they mean something like fighting words, which doesn't actually get protection of the First Amendment. Some people think that it means things that are directed towards groups of people based on their race or based on their gender. But that's not something that necessarily the courts have said does not get the protection of the First Amendment, although in limited contexts it's said in workplaces and in schools that it might. So I think we wouldn't necessarily want to come up with a new category, but we might really want to think about the implications of any particular regulation that might be attempting to address those harms. So for instance, if we're talking about criminal laws against non-consensual pornography or against certain forms of personal exposure or private information, someone's home address on social media, what always happens when those laws get passed is that there is a very strong First Amendment lobby, for lack of a better word, that says you can't have those regulations because no matter how badly we might feel for the poor woman who gets harassed, you know, we don't want to sacrifice the First Amendment to protect that. And I think that's the conversation we need to stop having, because that's really based on a caricature of the First Amendment and it's based on a trivialization of the harms that marginalized people suffer.
My phone's been buzzing throughout this interview. The ACLU was called 12 times. They want to have a bone to pick with you. I think they might be some of the primary worshipers at the altar of the First Amendment. What I'm hearing here, let me rephrase it and see if I'm getting it. You are more in favor of a balancing approach than you are to a more absolutist approach. So you would acknowledge that any regulation of speech or expression may very well have First Amendment implications. You wouldn't dismiss those arguments. But you would urge courts to look at the harm that's being addressed and to balance that harm against protecting speech in a more, shall we say, critical way. Is that a fair statement?
It's a fair statement, and I only refine it a little bit by saying it's not even the conversation that sometimes happens, which is the conversation as free speech versus your sense of even safety. I would actually argue that in many cases, it's free speech versus free speech. And what I mean by that is there have been some studies that have shown that far from chilling speech, strong harassment protections, that is to say prohibitions against certain types of conduct, actually encourage free speech. Now, how could that be the case? Well, if we think about it, it's not that strange. If we're no longer looking at simply a formalistic sense of the word, what does it mean to have free speech? It means that we have people who are willing to say what's on their minds without being afraid. When people know that they could be harassed or threatened or their families could be in danger because they're going to speak, we get people getting quiet. We get people silenced. So I would rather that we look at, if we're going to take a commitment to freedom of speech seriously, well, if you're committed to it, ask yourself in any given situation, is this the ideal situation to produce more speech? Or is it just that the more powerful people get to say a lot of things and everybody else just has to get quieter and quieter? I would say purely within the commitments of the First Amendment itself, we have to say if we're actually committed to freedom of speech, it sometimes will have to mean things like harassment regulations to make sure that people actually can feel as though they can speak.
And there's precedent for that. It's called low-value speech. Harassment, again, we'd have to define it a bit more, but if I'm simply hurling invective at you, and perhaps especially if it's simply based on who you are rather than your arguments, that doesn't really add much of anything to any particular argument, does it?
Some people think that it does. That's the problem.
Yeah, I'm certainly on the other side of this. Now, again, I'm very much coming from a perspective of First Amendment ascendancy and absolutism, because I hate any regulation of speech, just almost genetically. I just don't like it. It gets my hackles up. But I think I follow your argument that speech is itself low value and it squelches other speech, which is presumably of much higher value. And I can think of a couple analogies here. I mean, not to trivialize this, but I often think about the kindergarten classes that my children were in. You know, if one kid is running around and bothering all the other children and the other children don't want to participate and play, well, you got to take care of that kid, because otherwise you've just destroyed the entire atmosphere in the room and nobody gets to do anything. In my classrooms, if I have students who are simply more outspoken and aggressive than others, after a while, I will tend not to call on them, or I will tend to actively encourage other people to speak. And I realize that sometimes the other students are intimidated by those students simply because of their very aggressive behavior, and they just shut down. So if you want more speech, you have to regulate some speech, at least in a classroom or a kindergarten context, and maybe in a political context.
Well, we used to have some commitments like that, right? The idea that we used to force people, we used to force broadcasters to include rights of reply, right? That we might have had a commitment to diversity of speech as opposed to mere production of speech. And one of the things I think we have to get a handle on is what it is we think we're protecting when we protect freedom of speech. If it's just the freedom for people just to scream at each other, then of course we're going to have certain choices made in light of that. But the theories of freedom of speech have been something along the lines of promoting democracy, promoting autonomy, promoting the finding of truth. And so I think if we think that that's right, we have to ask ourselves whether or not the choices we've made today are getting us closer to a more informed democracy, a greater sense of autonomy on the part of the majority of our citizens, and whether or not we're getting better at finding truth. And if the answer is actually we're getting worse at all those things, and our supposed commitment to freedom of speech is causing us to be worse at those things, then obviously we failed in some dramatic sense. I'm personally uncomfortable with distinctions between low value and high value, not only because the Supreme Court has signaled that it's less willing now to think about those distinctions, but also because I worry about how you're ever going to classify those things in an objective way, right? One administration comes in and calls all kinds of things low value, and next administration comes in and says, no, actually, we think these other things are low value. So I think we need something more objective, which is something like, are we promoting democracy by this particular rule or regulation? Are more people feeling free to speak? Are people being discriminated against on the basis of something that we consider to be an illicit category based on where we are as a country? Not making stuff up, but saying that our 14th Amendment does say, and our anti-discrimination laws do say, you cannot single people out based on their gender and their race and their ethnic origin and their religion. It doesn't mean you have to be nice to people. It doesn't mean you have to agree with people. But if you're going to disagree with them or you're going to be critical of them, you can't silence people based on the fact that they are not the kind of people that you think should be talking. So we would want to shift the rules so that we actually had better quality speech and more people engaging in it than simply letting one group talk all the time and everybody else having to give way.
I'll play devil's advocate here. Much of politics is, unfortunately, identity politics. People who are the same gender or the same ethnicity, the same national origin, race, they do tend to associate with one another. They do tend to vote in blocks. And political debate, therefore, often revolves around the difference between us and them. Are we, if we allow regulation of speech that touches upon those categories, aren't we in danger of outlawing a whole lot of what we consider to be core political speech? That is very highly protected speech. It's very important to our democracy. So is there a danger here that we could go too far in discouraging harassment or discouraging this inappropriate speech?
I do think that that comes back to the question of how are we classifying what we would want to regulate. If we were going to say, as I think is the caricature sometimes, that the new regulations would be prohibiting people from saying bad things about each other, well, then I think, of course, that that would be a net loss for the First Amendment. We want our debate to be uninhibited, right, and robust and wide open, right, and all the things the court says. Now, what does that mean, though? Does it mean that you should repeatedly shout a racial slur 14 times over? Is that uninhibited and robust and wide open? And I'd argue that it's not. But I think it does go back to some of the pre-commitments that we have as a society, which is that we can be as nasty to each other as we would like to be, but those kinds of things should not actually result in the exclusion of or the intimidation of entire groups of people based on something irrelevant to their thoughts or to the quality of their contributions. So if I want to call someone an idiot because of their political views, that should always be protected. But whether I am allowed to threaten somebody or to harass somebody or to intimidate someone because of the race that they happen to be or the religion they happen to have, that seems much less reasonable because we, of course, want to make sure that those people also get to speak. And our current administration and Congress and our Supreme Court is predominantly white and male. We know this, and it's also predominantly Christian. That means that the kinds of things that we are promoting and the kinds of robust debate we are presumably having really isn't bringing everybody in. I mean, we have an 80% male Congress. It's a crazy thing to think when we think about half the population being female. It's over 90% white. That's also something that's quite hard to get our minds around. So when we think about that, we really have to ask ourselves, well, are we getting a very diverse or interesting or nuanced debate among all those people? Or is part of the reason why we keep replicating that very power structure, primarily white, primarily male, partly because we are pushing out everybody else, whether through a lack of protections for the First Amendment or some other reason?
Well, thank heaven our current political debate doesn't include name-calling and invective.
Indeed.
I mean, because that would be a terrible thing. You also made a very interesting argument at the intersection of the First and Second Amendments. And the starting point, I believe, was a discussion of Charlottesville, mm-hmm, and the terrible tragedy that happened there when the alt-right held its demonstration and several people died. Part of the issue there was the very liberal, or I should say very permissive, open carry law in the Commonwealth of Virginia. What do you think about all that?
So Charlottesville figures in my book quite prominently for all these reasons, because one of the things I'm most interested in the book is the intersection between certain rights. And what was so interesting about Charlottesville and tragic at the same time was the idea of the protest, the idea of the march itself was meant to be a First Amendment celebration in some ways. And it was the Virginia chapter of the ACLU that helped this rally to take place, not because the ACLU likes white supremacy, but because they believe that you need to be committed to an absolute form of free speech, and therefore we need to support even really unpleasant speech. But that's overlaid, of course, in Virginia with this open carry idea, which means that people can have weapons strapped to their chests as they're saying the things that they want to say. And what struck me as I'm watching the footage from Charlottesville is that we've got people who are claiming to be coming together to promote freedom of speech, to express their ideas, and there's people who are obviously disagreeing with their ideas and who would like to speak back to them, and you watch the interactions between them. Those people who have the Confederate flags and the swastikas also are the ones who had guns. And then you had all the counter-protesters who were largely unarmed. And you look at that scenario and you think, do we really think that this is a free speech conducive setting? Because if I'm in a position where I'm already faced with someone who's quite aggressive about their sense of racial superiority or gender superiority, but in addition to that, they have a weapon, ready at hand in front of me. How freely could anybody ever speak back to that kind of person? How freely could anybody demonstrate effectively or forcefully in what we would call an uninhibited and robust way if someone is actually armed in such a way that would suggest to any reasonable person that they could suffer violence at the hands of this person? So I think one argument we could make is that that interpretation, that open carry law, which advocates at least think of as being protective of the Second Amendment, that interpretation may undermine the First Amendment in very significant ways, that the more permissive you get about your interpretation of what the Second Amendment allows you to do, the more likely it is that those of us who are not taking advantage of that interpretation may feel that we cannot speak on pain of serious bodily injury.
A Second Amendment advocate might say, well, just go out and get your own gun.
And they do say that. And this is an interesting thought, right? That in the First Amendment context, we have something similar. And part of what I do in the book is I say that as much as they may not be fellow travelers in lots of other ways, the ACLU and the NRA actually do make a lot of the same arguments with their respective favorite amendments, which is if you have a problem with something, just do your own, right? If you have a problem with speech, you can just have counter speech. So if you have a problem with guns, we'll just have more guns, right? And I think in that context, what we are not thinking about is the fact that it shouldn't be incumbent upon people to be forced to engage in some type of activity or some form of action that they don't want to take part in simply because someone else is creating a situation where they're at a disadvantage to not do it. And we really need to ask ourselves what that would be solving. If someone says, I don't feel comfortable speaking to a person who's got a gun strapped to his back, so my resolution is I have to now go out and get a gun myself and hope that in this confrontation between one person with gun and another person with gun that neither one of us gets shot, or at least that it's not me, have we done anything to either protect the Second Amendment or the First Amendment? And, you know, of course, that conversation about firearms is overlaid with all the questions about the safety and security of those around you, because like many decisions that we tend to think of as being just about us, they turn out to not just be about us. A person who has a weapon affects the security and safety of everyone around them, whether they like it or not. You drop that weapon, you leave it somewhere, you have an accident, you are jeopardizing everyone around you. So the answer can't be, we'll let everybody do this really risky thing that some of us have decided we don't want to do. It doesn't sound like a principle that would comport with a free society to say the answer is to just have more weapons than the other guy.
In order to participate in the political debate, you got to come strapped.
Right.
Yeah, that's a very interesting argument, and I had not thought of it specifically about that. Indeed, it led me to ask you whether we might broaden the exception to the First Amendment protections for so-called true threats to encompass something that might more properly be called intimidation. I'm not necessarily threatening you directly, but I'm acting in a way that you would be intimidated, and quite reasonably, because there I am in my helmet, my Kevlar vest, and my quasi-military uniform with my AR-15. Mm-hmm. Maybe open carry laws are themselves constitutionally suspect, mm-hmm. because at least in the context of political rallies or gatherings, because of this intimidation factor and its effect upon free speech. And then you'd already were making that argument. That's exactly where you went. Yeah. So once again, I come up with an idea that somebody else has beat me to. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm in the midst of a perfectly fascinating discussion with Marianne Franks, who teaches at the University of Miami School of Law, and who's in the midst of writing a new book, The Cult of the Constitution. Stick around. And now let's finish our discussion with Marianne Franks of the University of Miami School of Law. Before the break, we were talking about the possibility that perhaps open carry laws that exist in some states can constitute a violation of the First Amendment rights of people who might be intimidated by the presence of guns in the midst of political discussions.
Well, I think that we should at least explore that option. Now, there is the question of state action, right? So it's a little harder in these cases to say that there's a First Amendment problem here with open carry. But the argument is something like that when a state decides to encourage or at a minimum tolerate people displaying openly their weapons, it should raise at least the question of whether or not that state action is endangering one of our other enshrined rights. And I think that there's at least a plausible argument to say that it is, that anyone who is engaging in open carry, especially when it comes to a public gathering of sorts, that they are essentially being given a kind of privilege to silence everybody else. And if we are truly worried about chilling effects and silencing effects, then we need to be very concerned about the ways that our attempts to protect other constitutional rights might undermine the ones that we think we're also trying to protect.
You also have a concern about the intersection between the First and the Fourth Amendment. Could you tell us about that a little bit, please?
Well, there's lots of intersections that I'm interested in, but the Fourth Amendment one is something that I don't get to reach that much in the book because I'm dealing already with the guns and the speech and the internet issues. But at least tangentially, or at least in part, we can talk about when we make these decisions about the First or the Second or any other amendment, or when we make major policy changes. Let's say, for instance, we are going from a concealed carry state to at least also permitting open carry to happen, or when we make changes about drug policies, for instance. When we think of what the Fourth Amendment is supposed to protect us from, it's supposed to protect us from unreasonable searches and seizures by the government. When we make major changes in the law regarding guns or drugs or anything, we change the nature of what is reasonable. Because in a non-open carry state, someone walking down the street with a weapon is suspicious in some ways. And it would not have been a problem, historically or otherwise, for a police officer to stop that person, not arrest them, but to ask them, you know, what are you doing with that
weapon?
What's
up? Why are you strapped with a military weapon?
For instance, right? That would be considered normal. If we think about what a Terry stop and frisk is, it's based on not probable cause, but reasonable suspicion that someone might be committing a crime. And carrying a gun in an openly like this could actually be suggestive of that in a way that seems reasonable. But once you change the gun laws, let's say, to say that you can have open carry, well, then it's no longer reasonable for a law enforcement officer to stop you and ask you what you're doing. Is that a choice that we want to make? Are we comfortable with the kinds of implications that that has for the Fourth Amendment? And I think it's not even just from the citizen's perspective only, but also the question from the police officer's point of view. Most law enforcement officers, I think, would say that they are troubled by the fact that these changes in the law are now changing how they are supposed to conduct themselves on the job, that they're now being told, well, you know, you think that you find this behavior suspicious, but because we changed the laws in this particular state, you can't actually act on that suspicion anymore. And depending on where our sympathies lie, we might think that's good or bad that law enforcement is going to have to defer to that calculus. But what it does, quite importantly, is it raises the specters of non-impartial enforcement, arbitrary enforcement, because the concern is that if you look at the Second Amendment context, how many cases have there been when a young black man is either reported to be carrying a weapon, even if he's not, or is in fact carrying a weapon or a toy gun, that law enforcement responds in the way that you would expect it would if we didn't have open carry or permissive policies towards guns. But when it's, let's say, Clive and Bundy in a standoff and he's just armed to the gills, we might say, well, we're going to back off and leave that person alone. It really highlights, I think, for us what's considered reasonable or unreasonable as a privacy intrusion, because the ways that these changes are working are being applied in a way that are, quite frankly, not at all equal. And if it turns out, as it seems to have done so in the Second Amendment context and also with drugs, if we know that these kinds of rules can be applied in a way that will further marginalize people who have already been marginalized, then I think we really then once again ask ourselves, we're back to the 14th Amendment. Are we protecting people equally? Do we really think, for instance, to put it provocatively, that anybody was standing up for Philando Castile's Second Amendment rights? Do we really think that Black Lives Matter is actually getting the same First Amendment protections as everybody else? And if the answer is no, then I think it really does, or it should, force us to reassess what kinds of constitutional choices we're making.
You said something there about changing what we define as reasonable. And without taking sides, I think that that is part of the gun lobby's, the NRA's objective, is to change society's view of weapons. And indeed, I, as I said this morning, I've been a gun owner since I was 11 years old. I grew up around guns, and I was in the military for a number of years and fired a number of their weapons, some of which were very big. But nonetheless, I sometimes wonder what's the end point of this? Do we really want to live in a country that's basically Dodge City circa 1880, where everybody's walking down the street with a weapon and, you know, disputes are settled with cold steel and hot lead? I mean, is that the end point? And sometimes some of the rhetoric I hear, an armed society is a polite society, and slogans of that sort lead me to believe that that's what it is. And that goes then back to the question of what kind of society do we want? What sort of democracy do we want? Is that actually going to promote more free and open exchange of ideas, or is it going to retard it?
And it's funny that you should mention Dodge City, because one of the things that the NRA has managed to successfully do around the gun debate is to make it sound as though we have this past of no gun control, when in fact, guns were highly regulated right up until the 1980s or so. And the NRA used to be in favor of any of those gun regulations. That what we're talking about now and the interpretation of the Second Amendment we have now, and it's why I focus on guns so much as an example of constitutional fanaticism, what the NRA has managed to do as a popular matter, the way that it's managed to transform any reasonable view of the Second Amendment into a quite hysterical and quite unfounded, textually or otherwise, view of guns everywhere is remarkable. And it's done so much damage to distort the public understanding of what it means to protect your Second Amendment rights, not, again, based on the text and not even based on whatever generous interpretation that was given to the Second Amendment in Heller when Justice Scalia says that there is an individual right. Justice Scalia makes it absolutely clear that that doesn't mean that it's an absolute right.
Oh, it's right there in the opinion.
Right there, and he says it expressly. But the National Rifle Association has managed to convince people, and it's important to note that they were not fond of the Heller case going forward, and you can think of why. It was much better for the gun lobby to not have an actual constitutional analysis of the Second Amendment, because they were going on wildly uninformed and emotional appeals to what people thought the Second Amendment was, how it felt to them. And so it's actually not great for them that there's now judicial scrutiny of, well, what did those words mean? And even though Heller, I think, is a terrible decision, and Scalia completely throws out his so-called textualist commitments, he throws them out of the window, even if I didn't think that was the case, at least what it does is it gives it something like an analysis that's based on language, and it's not at all what the NRA is telling people the Second Amendment is. And now we're working towards a society where you've got people who are convinced now that any restriction on any kind of firearm possession or carriage is somehow violating their constitutional rights.
Funny story. Maybe 5 years ago, I was asked, I forget the group, to come down and talk about gun rights, Heller. And I did, and in an almost offhanded way, I said, well, you know, no constitutional rights absolute, so neither is the Second Amendment. And I actually read that passage from Justice Scalia's opinion. Headline, next day, law professor says Second Amendment not absolute. And what? There is no such thing as an absolute right or an absolute anything in the law.
Right.
I thought this was just a run-of-the-mill, you know, sort of a preliminary discussion, and now we'll talk about what Heller said. Wow. It was stop the presses.
And this is the amazing thing, and what I do try to draw out in my book is that single-mindedness, the sense of this amendment is special. You do see it in the First Amendment context too. It's the same kind of rhetorical move that no matter what the cost, right, we have to absorb it. That's the sense in which we say it's absolute. When those of us are maybe not that sympathetic to the gun argument, some of us tend to be very sympathetic to the free speech argument, which says that it doesn't matter how much damage is done, we have to be committed to this principle. But isn't that exactly what the Second Amendment fanatics are also saying? No matter how many dead kids, no matter how many deaths a year, it's important that we have this particular right. It's more important than anything. Wayne LaPierre will say this. Nothing is more important than your right to life, which he completely elides into the right to have a gun. And he says that's the right that every other right has to be subordinated to. But that's the same rhetoric that the ACLU uses when it comes to freedom of speech. And that's exactly the kind of attitude and the kind of perspective that I'm trying to challenge.
I teased you at the outset of this interview that you had come in challenging the religion of which this place is the center. But in all seriousness, I think that James Madison, whose home this was, would much more appreciate a nuanced argument about what these rights mean, the very arguments that you are bringing forward, than he would hero worship. He was not a man who sought fame. He was a very retiring and modest man. He was a man who was focused on the ideas, not who wrote them. And he would have been the last to join a cult of the Constitution. So maybe your coming here is not so blasphemous after all. In any event, we thank you for doing so, Marianne. This has been fascinating. What is the name of your book?
The Cult of the Constitution, Guns, Speech, and the Internet.
And when is it coming out?
It's coming out later this year. I don't know the exact month.
Will you let us know so we can help you promote it?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much. Now it's time for our constitutional quiz, recorded live before an audience at the Virginia State Finals of the We the People competition, where I was ably assisted by Meg Hubeck of the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia, and by Stephanie Heshen, who at my request went out in the audience And look for a girl rather than a boy, because those boys, they just tend to volunteer too much.
We have not a stinky boy, but a beautiful girl who has a boo-boo foot, so she can't stand, but we're not going to let her
foot.
Get out of it. Yep,
okay.
Boo-boo foot. Yep.
We won't ask you how that happened.
The good thing is you don't need your foot to answer a question.
Nope. That's right.
So I'm coming down here, and she's going to have to answer. Are we ready?
Can I know your name first and where you're from?
I'm Maddie, and I'm from Woodgrove High School.
Yeah. Awesome.
You people can do better than that. Mr. Bennett, tell your students to show who they are.
Is that our senior class president, Daniel Shelton?
All right, tremendous.
That was good.
Sorry, Maddie.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. According to the Constitution, must the president make a public State of the Union address?
Well, yeah.
A, yes, he or she must present a public address to Congress. B, yes, he or she must present a written State of the Union, but is not required to formally address Congress. C, no, Congress creates its own report on the State of the Union. D, no, the president can decide whether or not to present Congress with a State of the Union report. And E, none of the above.
B.
What's B?
B, yes. Bing, 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 bing. Uh-huh. So the Constitution requires the president to submit a State of the Union report, a written one. But the traditional, they can, if they want, give a public address. But that's only been a recent tradition.
The Constitution simply specifies that once a year, the president has to report to Congress on the State of the Union. That can be done and has been done and was done for many years just with a written report, which was then read aloud, typically by the clerk, to the assembled House of Representatives and Senators. Those who chose to show up that day. In later years, in recent years, the president has decided to use this as an opportunity to appear in person, probably something that has been affected by the advent of radio and television, because it's an opportunity for the president to politic a bit and also simply to advocate for his or eventually her positions on important matters of state. So that was a good question, Meg. Thank you.
There's just way too much clapping in the State of the Union.
It's coming
Plus,
up
it's
soon.
Past my bedtime.
It's past your bedtime?
Past my bedtime, so, and they won't hold their applause till the end.
So you pull your Justice Ginsburg act and you fall asleep during the State of the Union.
Yes, I read about it the next morning.
I understand. Okay.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Marianne Franks of the University of Miami School of Law. Marianne is a really nice person in addition to being as accomplished as she is, and I had a heck of a time teaching a seminar with her at Montpelier. I hope it happens many times again. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our assistants at this week's constitutional quiz were Meg Hubeck of the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia and Stephanie Hessian, our own Oprah Winfrey. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.